Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You know, that reminds me, if there's a famous picture out there, you talk about things being done differently. The very first Super Bowl, Len Dawson, the quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs, sitting on the sideline, got a Fresca, I think, in one hand and a cigarette. No, I don't know if it's a Fresca or a beer, but something in one hand and a cigarette in the other. This is, you know, during the game.
Of course, everybody, now you're not allowed to show it. Mickey Mantle and those guys in the locker room, you know, with a cigarette and a beer or a cigarette and a cocktail with their uniforms on, you know, but
yeah, it's all branding. Well, let's do this now. Let's talk about this because we want to get in. You got a couple neat cases that we want to talk about. So before we do that, let's kind of set the stage. So cases, I want to mention heroin, but what we have to do before we get to heroin, we have to figure how the hell did you get out of the AFU, the AFU, the asset forfeiture unit, and get to doing some real police work?
Well, after doing the tour every afternoon and helping out, and like I had mentioned before, this one man who was a real nice man, on one of my first or second times covering a meeting, again, I don't have any real background in this. It's clear to me because I'm listening and nobody else is. He's pretty drunk inside a bar with a bad guy and the informant. And I hear the other agents on surveillance starting to say, remember, I have no background on this, but I'm picking up just through osmosis. What the hell? Is Jack fucking doing it again? All right. How long are we going to be here? This is getting out of control. All right. And they would say, what's the kid say? I can hear him. What's the kid say? That's me, you know. And I'm telling him, well, he's still talking to like this bad guy. And, you know, is he drinking? And I'm like, oh, I think so. But, you know, and
it's audio, not video.
Yeah. And about an hour and a half later, out walks the agent, the undercover agent with the informant. You know, he's draped. You know, the informant's literally carrying him to the informant's car. Bad guy says hello. They walk off and say goodbye. And that was one of my first sort of like realize, you know, look, this it's like that saying, this isn't Kansas, Dorothy, you know. And again, I'm not I mentioned this because we're keeping it real. It was an issue. And, you know, we're not going to go there because we could talk about a lot there. And I'm glad that a lot of that has been improved, but a lot of our elder mentors, they didn't have a good background with that. They drank a lot, they weren't healthy, and some of them probably died prematurely because of it. You know, they weren't. I don't know what you remember, guys. From sure, it was just different times.
When I got on the police department, our chief of police was a Marine formerly on active duty. We could not go to bars. We could not have mustaches.
Wow.
And then when I got on the state patrol, same thing. I only had in our class, 1984 was only the third female ever in the, at that time, 50-year history. It's now over 75 history of the Ohio Patrol. So, yeah. But, you know, people want to talk about stuff. But to your point, it was a different time. Things evolve. If we'd done things the way they've always done it, we'd still be wearing wool uniforms, you know, on the state patrol and stuff, you know.
Jesus. And I got to say, I didn't know that you were classified as a female when you went through your class. That explains a lot. Thank you, Morgan.
We're in the wool.
Sorry, I couldn't pass it up. Yeah. Remember, I know where you live. I've been to your house. I know the layout.
I got you. I love you, brother.
Yeah, okay, whatever. Back to our regularly scheduled. That divergence, you know, that one is on Murph, not on me. So a digression. So back to it. So how did you get out of AFU?
So after doing a lot of help, one of the bosses and one of the group said, no, we're getting this kid in here because he's like a peacock. You know, I say I'm like a peacock because I didn't know shit about law enforcement, but I spoke Cubano Spanish and I knew how to get us around town. Remember, there's no GPSs. You should have seen the messes on cases on surveillance. Guys would end up like in 10 miles away. Oh, and yeah. Like, I'm thinking, this is not good. These are
remember
feds.
Those big ass, the big, big map books we all carry.
Yeah, that was, so I distinctly remember every afternoon when everybody went home in the AFU, I'd show up in different groups, you know, with my gun strapped on and probably looking a little too amped up. And I'll never forget this guy that ended up in that group that I finally get to go to, an older guy. He was assigned when I got there to help me out, sees me, and he calls me over. Finally, he goes, listen, kid, I'm going to be helping you out here. So I just want to tell you something. Do you know that show Miami Vice? I go, yeah, yeah. He goes, do you like it? I go, yeah, yeah, I do. I like it. I've seen it. He goes, well, remember, kid, you're young, you're smart, you're good looking. You are Miami Vice. Calm the fuck down.
Yeah, man. You know?
He said that to me just like that. And I'm like, what? Like, then he goes, you are Miami Vice. Calm the fuck down. You know? And I don't know what he meant by that.
Well, showing up in your silk shirt and your $29 silk tie?
By then I ditched the Giorgio Brutini loafers and my suits. I was just trying to be cool. Yeah. No, by then I had the whole guayabera. And the flowing shirts. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But he just kind of thought this kid's too wound up. But this poor guy, and I finally get there. You ask me, I'm going to get to that case. I had no background on this. So every day he helps me with the paperwork. My boss, Dennis, says, hey, we'll help you. You know, so I would go to him and he'd help me write my reports. But I'd notice when he came back every afternoon, He'd go to Ma Grundy's and apparently he'd had a martini or two. And again, remember, I'm young. I don't want to say anything. And this guy's got that dragon breath blowing me out of my like desk next to him with that, you know, liquor fueled breath mixed in with a nasty tuna sandwich. Oh. And I'm sitting there and he's like slurring his speech. So the boss finally sees me looking around after a couple of days and he calls me in. And again, hand to God, he says, listen, Alex, Vietnam veteran, spent a few years in NYPD and he's a good man. He's going to retire here soon. And let me give you a piece of advice, kid. If it's probably better if you try to ask him to help you in the mornings than in the afternoons. This is my boss. And I'm like, okay. And heaven forbid I say, yeah, because he's, you know, shit-faced drunk. No. But great men. I admired them. But as I grew older, like I said, I drew a certain amount of empathy for them because they didn't have all these resources and sort of you know, mechanisms to kind of catch you. But there I meet, A.D. Wright, the legendary Adolphus P. Wright, and Dave Gaddis, Chris Feistel. And
well, we had Dave Gaddis on. We had Feistel. Yeah.
And we'll have to get A.D. on.
You need to get him on. He again, is lore with his toughness and whatnot. So I start really like my first case with Chris Feistel, and we're investigating these African guys that were somehow set up in Miami, and they were from Ghana specifically. And back then, that was like a very rare, rare thing.
Well, I guess it was all cocaine at the time. So heroin was actually very rare in Miami at the time.
Extremely. Very rare, very rare. And then later, as you know, we'll bypass the history lesson. You know, they started to synthesize it in, you know, opium in Colombia. But before then, these guys were bringing it in from Africa, and they had some connections up in New York. So, very like you said, they did also have connections with Colombians. And the informant said, "Hey, look, the guy was called Sam. I'll never forget." Sam Manco was the African guy, and very interesting case. But you know, the case took us to Virginia. When I say Virginia, the DC area, and that's when I realized that law enforcement is not created equal as far as the application of law in South Florida. And man, Steve, you remember, you know, a lot of guys would get bond and they would do what we used to nickname the Avianca shuffle. You know, they'd be that afternoon, you know, on a plane and your guy was gone and, you know, fugitives galore. But this case, there is this guy, and to this day, I still feel bad for him. His name was very common Hispanic name, like Raul Garcia. So I approached this guy, and he was one of the cocaine suppliers to this guy. And we tell him with our prosecutor that he should consider taking a plea here in Miami because, you know, the alternatives are not good, and he's being investigated up in this thing called the Eastern District of Virginia. Hence, back then, maybe today, it's called the Rocket Docket. And that's where there was no... Yep, it's still there.
How much heroin were we talking about at that time?
Not like mega, like hundreds. I would say we ended up seizing about, over the whole thing, about like 8 or 9 pounds of heroin, you know, which was a lot. Back then, that was a lot. Different. We ended up getting 1 pound once, and we got 3 pounds, and then we got 3 pounds.
So if you remember the price between heroin and cocaine, you know, per kilo, you know, what was, how did they translate out? What was more expensive at that time?
The heroin was by weight. And by then, I distinctly remember before I come on the job, sadly, Mercury Morris, who was a hero of mine,
great Miami back of the Dolphins, man.
Yeah. And he gets tangled up in some cocaine thing in the very early 80s. And a key of coke back then was about 50 grand. When I get to Miami and Steve, it plummets at one point to like, I think it's down to 11 or 12,000 dollars for a key of coke, because it was just, you know, so plentiful. But this guy Raul Garcia is getting bad legal counsel, and he essentially gets indicted instead of in South Florida, the Southern District. He gets indicted up in Virginia, and that's when the end of the world starts and my vision of the Rocket Docket.
Well, you said it's, you were talking earlier, you said something about not because he got too cute, but because his lawyer got too cute, right?
Yep, absolutely. And again,
what did he do to be too cute that he didn't take the deal down there and then instead now is up here in the Eastern District of Virginia?
Well, because it was, you know, that was a true, somewhat of an international case because of the heroin. And of course, it was multi-jurisdictional. And we had some connections to D.C. So we had a very good prosecutor. So he gets indicted up there. He'd come up for a couple of meetings. So I'm sitting there as the case in chief at the table for this guy. And I'm going to give you the scene because his last name is, ironically, back then, his last name was Trump. Don Trump was the AUSA. And he says, this is not going to go well. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, you're going to see. So this guy, Raul Garcia, brings up counsel from Miami. And it's now Monday. And this guy shows up like 2 hours late. And you see this judge that the name is escaping me or not, but I'm seeing him, little glasses on his nose. He was actually put there, I think, during the Eisenhower administration. He'd been on the bench like 50 years. No-nonsense guy. So in comes Raul Garcia's attorney with a ponytail, ostrich skin cowboy boots, and this like...
I already can tell this ain't going to go well. No.
And he's got this double-breasted suit, and he's sashaying up to the bench. Your Honor, Joel Scheinbaum for the defense. I'm going to need a 2-hour continuance because I've been handling some very important matters in Florida, and I was just getting to town last night, so I need some time to confer with my client. And all of a sudden, the judge, I swear to God, he's rocking back and forth, and this is not exaggeration. He sits and he goes, Mrs. Smith, the court reporter, what do you got on your calendar for today? Your Honor, I got the United States versus Garcia. Mr. Johnson, what do you have on your calendar for today? Your Honor, I got the United States government versus Garcia. Mr. Trump, how about you? Yes, Your Honor, I've got United States versus Garcia. He goes, so do I. I don't understand, Mr. Scheinbaum, why you don't have it too. proceed. And there it went down from, that was what he said to the guy. Now this guy's now, so I'm looking at the defendant.
That sounds like a scene out of My Cousin Vinny. I'm sorry.
No. Exactly. But the whole time he's like kind of rocking, not even looking, looked like he was almost like half asleep, but he's making, and that's, I'm not exaggerating his accent. So we'll proceed then. So I think he gives a guy like 10 minutes out of courtesy probably for the thing. Another thing, I look over and I say to the prosecutor, I go, there's a lady in the jury box. She's doing a rosary, you know, and you might say, what's wrong with that? I that's not good when you got some little old lady doing a rosary over there. And they got all these guys from Miami talking about tons of coke and heroin and debauchery and it would go on. And then this guy, it was like a comedy thing because the judge would be rocking like this. And then he was thrown off his thing. He would try to start, you know how some attorneys start walking around? He would say, Mr. Sheinbaum, podium, please, podium. He would make him stay behind the podium. And every time he tried to get cute, you know, that whole walking over toward the jury, and he would rock, say, podium, Mr. Sheinbaum, podium. And then he would sit there, Your Honor, objection, denied, proceed. And he would just go back and forth, asked and answered, proceed. And he just took this poor guy off his game. And when he first asked them, he goes, how long do you think this is going to take? He goes, Your Honor, this is at least a week. He goes, a week? I don't understand. I think we'll be done by tomorrow. You know, and it was just, and every time this guy tried to come up with some South Florida BS argument, podium, Mr. Sheinbaum, proceed, denied.
See, I think people got to understand too, I never spent as much time in federal court as you guys did, but my few times in there, a good federal judge is like God on earth. They know how to run everything.
Oh, God, yeah.
They keep things moving.
This is not about, hey, we're not doing stuff on your schedule. We're doing stuff on my schedule. Now, let's get going.
Yeah, no, and you know, at the time, why is this part of the story? Because Steve will tell you, back then in Miami, I guess there was just so much action going on. Only the worst of the worst got kept in prison, and the judges, I'll be honest, I felt they showed a significant amount of deference to the defense bar, probably because a lot of these lawyers someday figured, I mean, these judges figured maybe I'll be one of them. And there were some big hitters. You remember, Steve, you know, Roy Blacks and a lot of, So they'd come in and they were demigods. And I think that, but in the Eastern District of Virginia, that dog just don't hunt. And it was just and you know what? It didn't actually end Tuesday afternoon, like the judge had said. It went Wednesday morning. But poor Raul Garcia got hit with 15 years, and he would have got 5 in Miami. He'd have come in, you know, done a rule 35, would have, you know, served up a few guys to someone like me. I said, you know how it works. You serve a few guys, you'll get a little bit of time off, and you'll come out. But the poor guy got sentenced up there to 15 years, and that was my story of the Rocket Docket. And you know, justice is not always equal.
Yeah, no, and but I have no sense.
Or not equally applied. Let's put it that way.
Well, go ahead, Steve.
I just have no sympathy for him. He got himself into the pickle and
other mistake he made was hiring a South Florida lawyer. What he should have done is got one up there that understood the system, that understood the court, and understood the judge.
Of course, that's rule one. I look over my life, I've had a handful of instances, I'm sure you guys too, where people have called for different things, family members or issues. I said, listen, I don't know a whole lot I can tell you, but do get local counsel. I learned that a long time ago. Do get local counsel. Don't bring in some big gun from out of town because it doesn't usually work. I don't care how good he is.
We had a case in North Carolina, of all places, and the source was a guy his first name was Malik. I'll never forget. And he was bringing like 15 keys of powder down to Salisbury, North Carolina, north of Charlotte at a time. And this was happening on a weekly basis or so. I mean, he's bringing a good amount of dope in. And we were able to do not only a substantive count, but we also did a conspiracy count. So he starts out with this New York lawyer. Lawyer comes down, reviews the evidence, goes back to his client, says, Malik, you need to take a plea deal on this one. You know, you're looking at 20 to life. So he's like, you're fired, goes and gets a Miami attorney. Guy comes in, looks at the evidence. I mean, the phone records, the stack was probably 4 feet tall, you know, the toll records that we had on this guy. And, you know, the prosecutor called him and says, you interested in a plea deal on this? He's like, nope, I've seen the evidence. We're going to trial. Malik is doing life in federal prison. On his judgment committal order, it says date of release upon death. All because of that, what you just said, getting an out-of-town attorney.
I believe it. I believe it.
Tell you what, man. Have you guys not seen My Cousin Vinny? That's the only time getting an out-of-town attorney works for you. Otherwise than that, it doesn't work.
It doesn't. So that was my first sort of a multi-jurisdictional case and my introduction. Since then, I'd been in dozens of out-of-town courtrooms. I'll give you the last one because I still remember. We went to Puerto Rico, right? And of course, you know, it's Puerto Rico. So,
Wait a minute. What do you mean by that? No.
On another matter. Actually, it was the next case. But speaking about multi-jurisdictional things is, we're in U.S. federal court in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and all of a sudden I'm sitting there, and then it is now the Honorable Juan Rodriguez Fernandez presiding, and we shall begin. And the court is now in order. Okay, approach the bench. Okay, ahora que vamos a hacer. So then they would fucking call us to the bench, the two lawyers and the judge, and they're talking in Spanish. And then everybody goes back to, they're saying, goes, okay, we agreed that the bond is now 500,000. I'm thinking, this is not supposed to be this way. It's got to be in English, you know. But it was like they would sit there in Spanish, then we go back and put it like three sentences in English. Okay, we agree to the bond. Okay, finished.
Yeah. Different place.
Yeah, and I would say, what are you guys doing up there? And I could hear them talking, no, porque tú sabes, por favor, dile que vamos.
You know, see, isn't it amazing how an hour of conversation in Spanish can be reduced down to two sentences in English?
Yeah. And of course, arms are flailing. It's all animated. Then it comes back and it gets put on the record for three sentences. Okay, all right, sounds whatever. And I thought that was funny as shit.
We have a plea deal, Your Honor. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think the record is supposed to cover all that stuff you guys said, but hey, I'm good. I'm just a working agent.
I get what you mean now, it's Puerto Rico. So they kind of,
and they didn't mess around though. They did it, but they did it their way. And again, I had, again, great cops down there and the judges were good. I will tell you, but I just found that was an interesting thing in camera. I bet that happens in a lot of courtrooms. A lot of stuff gets done in camera.
Oh yeah. No, look, they used to say the only justice in the halls of justice takes place in the halls. They work out everything in the halls. You know, I can't tell you how many times I went to court. You're waiting there for an hour, and then they come and say, okay, we cut a deal. You guys could have done this yesterday, like, right? Help me out here. Working midnights or being on a, you know, four days out, you know, on an investigation. And anyway, I digress. But hey, let's talk. This is a fun one, though. The next one I wanted to talk to you about, you brought up. This is actually cool because I think this is where you overlap with Murph. This is where we get into some good drama here because it involves a pilot, a tree, and cojones. So,
oh God, yeah,
a pilot, a tree, and
cojones. Hey, if there was ever a lead in, there you go. So
that could be the name of a movie:
Pilot, Tree, and Cojones. Yeah, or a new drink down at at the hotel. So let's talk about this smuggling case though with Colombia, because obviously your Spanish skills are going to be needed. But what's the context? How did this thing get set up?
This thing is what was very common. I believe Steve's group were the vanguard group in Miami that did these big time smuggling cases. Was it Group 10? Was it Group 10?
Yeah, international
smuggling, and they were the cat's meow. But we'd put one together, and the real quick version is, unlike today, you didn't have to go through a lot of approval processes, or we didn't know we had to, as far as flying down into Colombia without notifying the Colombians. Hell, sometimes maybe DEA maybe didn't know because things were done at the last minute. So it was not uncommon for like informants to be shared sometimes with other groups and pilots. So this poor pilot goes down there to pick up a load, and the next thing we hear is he's yelling at the top of his lungs that he is tied to like a tree and he's down to his skivvies, and that if they don't pay, these Colombians, I forget the figure, like $200,000 that the other informant who forgot to tell us that he'd probably screwed these bad guys over and didn't think they'd show up, but they did, and they put it together. So now our informant pilot is in his skivvies, and he says, on the phone through to the informant, which we got it, he says, these guys have got a machete, and they're going to cut my nuts off if you don't pay them the money they're owed. So we're like, holy shit, now what do we do? Now what do we do? Because we didn't want the guy to get killed. We then, I forget if it, where that part I don't remember, we find another informant that flies down there. Talk about the onions on these guys. And he goes down there and makes peace with these traffickers, saying, look, this poor pilot does not have your money. It's not his fault. If you give him the dope and let him bring this shipment down, you will be paid not only for this, but I give you my word that it'll happen. And, you know, we're listening to this sometimes on the two-way radio, and you know, it happened. It happened. I don't think that guy was ever the same. The pilot, when he flew back to Miami with that load, I think his name was...
You ever be the same if somebody had a machete out there?
Yeah. He got off the plane and he was just like cursing, and you know, we paid him. We remunerated him very well, and rightfully so.
There you go with the financial term, remuneration.
Right. And he did his job, but it was just crazy stuff that today, if you said, we already have a guy that's kidnapped, he's going to get killed, let's double down and let's fly another guy down there, they would tell you you're crazy.
Murph, who does this sound like?
Sounds like a good plan, boss. Are you kidding? They'd walk you out of the building and say, this guy's nuts. But we did it back then. Steve did it. He did it all the time.
Well, who was Luis Navia Rascogno?
Rascogno.
Rascogno,
North Valley Cartel.
Yeah, we had a guy, Luis Navia, on, twice, right? Could have killed him twice.
Yeah. Well, once there, and then the Mexicans got him, and Mexico were going to feed him to alligators. Remember, they were taking him out, and a phone call came in. The whole thing saved his life.
Yeah, Rascogno actually let him go, because I guess the record was, if you were kidnapped by Rascogno, you were going to lose that engagement.
Oh, he was known for skinning people alive and then, you know, torturing them and then kill them. So this guy,
let's talk a little bit more about this case. So how did it get to the point of where this so how did you go about flipping, you know, finding the pilots? Because the one thing I really liked about your guys' approach too was the only way to get coke from there up to here was transportation, right? So it's either going to be a boat or a plane, most likely. So going after the pilots.
Both. You know, it was still pretty commonplace. You'd fly them out. They would fly either into the Bahamas. And just the airdrops. It was not that complicated. You'd have these go-fast boats, you know, the different brands. You could put about 500-600 keys in the hull of one of those things at the time. And they would, you know, they'd have the Kel lights, they drop them in the water and pick them up. It wasn't that complicated in different places. But you're going to say you are the most compassionate, and almost like sad DEA agent. I did it with Chris on this case that I kind of still to this day feel bad about. These guys are now bringing a load of cocaine. We're trying to keep this case going without getting burned.
And when you say these guys, are they tied?
I'm sorry.
A cartel or, you know, which group?
This is a smuggling organization that we have an informant into, that they have boats and they're bringing cocaine. And we're trying to figure out how can we seize some of these shipments without tipping our hand. So we were always trying to find places outside of Miami to interdict the cargo. So we make a decision when we're tracking this thing and it stops in the Dominican Republic and it's there for like 6 hours. And we end up contacting DEA in the DOM rep, who gets the Dominicans on board. So we tell them, do not go straight to where it is. Do make it appear like a happenstance kind of a search. And now we're going back and forth on the phone every like 25 minutes to half hour. That I'll never forget. The guy was called Captain, was the Dominican captain in charge of this operation. And the DEA agent is telling me he can't find it. And he's getting frustrated. I go, just keep looking. It's there. It's there. So all of a sudden I get a call and I am told Captain found it. So I go down there about a week later, and I go to see one of these guys in the Dominican prison that he wanted to cooperate. There were four of them. He did not look good. And it appears that Captain Lee at some point took some liberties. And again, this is, I did not do this. This was not a statute of limitations. I'm going to, you know, I didn't do this. It appears that Captain Lee took some liberties with a pipe and the guy's shins. And this guy apparently pointed immediately to where the contraband was. And this guy was started crying to me and said, I'll go to Florida and I'll plead to anything. I'll plead to life, but you got to get me out of here because, and I that was like a bad Fellini movie, what that prison looked like. So we get to Miami and these guys are now being charged in Miami, Florida, in the Southern District.
Well, hold on before you get there. So what did it take to get them out of the custody of the Dominicans? Because obviously at that point, the crime's committed in the Dominican Republic, you know, it's the DR. What kind of things do you have to do to get them to agree to release them into U.S. custody for extradition?
Sure. No, that's a great question. And first of all their attorneys were pushing for it. The AUSA spoke to the prosecutors there. At the end of the day, the Dominicans, they don't want to deal with this. These were actually American citizens. You know, they were Cubans, but they were American citizens, and they don't need the added sort of stuff. So they were happy after like 2 months to extradite them to South Florida. So that's how it happened. Is I'm not saying that they would always do that, but they didn't have a problem, I guess, when they realized this was part of a bigger case. So that's how they ended up in the courtroom there, and that's where my world continues to get very uncomfortable with Captain when he appears in a South Florida courtroom.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that, because if I'm a defense attorney, I'm licking my lips at this one. I'm going, you know, this is going to be a fun one. I could use the fact that there's no doubt in your mind at this point, and probably these folks either, this guy has been beat with a pipe, right? He has been physically abused to the point of where he's given up a confession that may or may not stand in a U.S. courtroom, right?
Right, right.
How do you handle that?
Well, here's how we handled it is we end up bringing down the four guys. Two of them plead guilty, and they're just happy to be at the Club Fed, you know, a long-term guest of, you know, the Bureau of Prisons, considering the hellhole they were at in the Dominican Republic prison that they were in. And the other two rolled the dice. And I had no choice but to reach out to the Dom rep and said, because the captain was the guy who handled this, I had to bring him to Miami to testify. He speaks no English. He's all of about 5'2". Okay. So
a little bit of Napoleon complex then?
I don't know. He seemed like a decent enough guy, but I don't know him all that well. So the AUSA says to me, is there anything we need to know to put Captain on the stand? And I said, Bill, I would rather not put him on the stand. Can't we somehow just talk to this? Can't I somehow read the reports? He goes, nope. We're going to have to put Captain on the stand. Fine. So I said to him, you know that Captain Luna comes from a country where things are a little bit different, and I'm giving him the win. And he's glaring at me. He knows what I'm saying, you know, and I can't tell you what he's going to I can't tell you what he's going to say. So Captain Luna comes into Miami. I'm not there with him. He comes in the night before. I meet him. I stick him at the Holiday Inn down the street from the courtroom. And I have one of the other agents to go pick up Captain. So I tell him, you're going to come to a courtroom, you'll be sworn in, and then you'll just talk to him, right? So the doors of the courtroom, this is true. Again, I'm not exaggerating. There's certain things I'll tell you, I'm just making a joke. The doors, I don't know why, he must have pushed them, and they flip open. And here you got this 5'1" guy dressed like a tin pot dictator with a uniform with regalia everywhere, this hat that looked like the size of a small ship on his head with all those gold encrusted things. And he like sashays down the aisle, like looking for like I'm like, and then Bill looks over and he's glaring. I don't even want to make eye contact. I feel his, my ear is burning. And I see Captain dressed like one of those like Borat movie guys. You know what I mean?
Manuel Noriega.
Yes, yes. So he goes up there and he takes off his hat and he's got that whole stuff on. And then it's the translator. It's I, of course, can hear. And I'm like, oh, God, here we go. And you know, we put him on. He explains that they find the cocaine. Here comes the defense attorney. Do you know my client? He goes, yes, I do. Sí, señor. You know what I mean? And then he says, I have to ask you a very question, good, simple question right out of the start. Did you at any point hit my client in the leg with a pipe? And you see Sitcher, and he like stiffens up and he goes, in the something along the lines in Spanish in a very formal, he goes, in the application of law enforcement, there are mechanisms that must happen. And I'm like, oh God. And what mechanism was that? Did you use a pipe to have my client tell you where the cocaine was? You need to understand, is now pointing at the, he goes, these are delinquents. These are men that need to be treated with a firm hand. Now I've got Bill like staring at me like, you are screwing this up, Alex, by bringing this crazy guy here. So it starts to go back and forth and pointing at the defendants. Esos son delincuentes. And now he's just yelling, these are delinquents. They must be dealt with a firm hand. And I'm like, oh God, you know, and you know what? It was honest. He, I forget if he admitted, I don't think he actually said I hit him. But it was clear after a few times, the judge, you know, probably being a foreign cop or something. But this is like a movie stuff too, by the way. This was movie type stuff to see this guy dressed like that. And I'm thinking, you don't, this is the United States. You can't do that. And he walked his ass out. I saw him later that afternoon, bought him a beer, put him on a plane, just get him out of here. And you know what? I don't know if this is going to sound crazy. They got convicted.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
They did get convicted.
I'm thinking that, so I'm a little shocked because I'm thinking the minute you start talking, I mean, that's the equivalent of torture. You know, you beat somebody with the pipe. Now, did you
he
ever?
He never said he did. And
yeah.
No. Look, I'm not saying that today or in another court that would have flown.
Yeah.
You know, it was a conspiracy, but it was a conspiracy case. There were multiple acts. This was just one of several overt acts that maybe even if the judge would have said to throw out the whole thing about that shipment, they
still would have gone to prison. Yeah.
Probably. But they didn't rule 29 them, which is, you know, an outright, you know, judge's acquittal. So, but yeah, made me feel very uncomfortable for about a half hour dressed like that.
As
like
well as the scene. USA making you feel uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. What's he going to say? Well, I don't know.
Now, did you, I mean, so when you're talking to the assistant United States attorney, the AUSA, were you kind of hesitant to have a very clear conversation with him about he hit him with the pipe? You were just trying to get around it by saying, hey, they do things a little different down there. Maybe he applied a little bit too much force or.
No. He knew. And I told him that he may have been, you know, roughed up. I didn't have pictures. I didn't have any specifics that it was a pipe. No one ever, what do you call it? The only way I know that is because when I went to speak to the defendant, he gave me that very graphic thing. And I'm not saying I disbelieved the defendant, and I didn't say anything, and that, hey, this is what's going to happen. And he's like, I don't care, you know, kind of I don't care. He says, I'll do what I got to do. And that's when and he testified in Spanish. Yeah.
It's a different, you know, again, different countries. I mean, every time I've been into like probably 30, 40 different countries, you know, you come back a couple times there, you land, the first thing you want to do is get on that tarmac and just kiss the ground and go, thank God I am back in the good old U.S. of A.
Yes. They, like I said, they probably spent 10 years very happily somewhere in Kentucky or in, I don't think they went to Panama City, right? That's like a level one.
Who did we have? One of the guys we had on was in Panama City. Might have been Ryjock, or
I think it was Ken, or Luis Navia.
Luis Navia, that's right. He was in Panama City, one of the fine federal correctional institutions run by the United States government.
Yeah, but that's not a hard place. That's I don't even think they have fences in a couple of these
he
places.
Was playing in a band. He had drums. And
They
paint lines on the grass, and you can't step over them.
Actually, Stephen, in your old neck of the woods, there's a Morgantown. That's got bushes. I remember going there once, and I go, where's the fence? He goes, no, it's those bushes. They don't run. Yeah. Morgantown is just has like a little fencing around it. It's nothing, no big deal, because it's a low priority, low security. Morgantown. I went there once to talk to a guy, and it didn't look like a terribly bad existence. Truth be told, like you said, one guy had a band.
Yeah, Luis Navia played in a band while he was there.
He was. You remember Keith Kaminsky?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So he worked with customs and helped to arrest Luis Navia in Venezuela as they were getting ready to transport. Was it 26 tons? 26 of cocaine tons to Europe.
Yeah. On a big, their whole scheme was they were using huge ships. I mean, you could hide a ton of stuff on those ships, and that's what they were doing, is getting them out of there. But all right. So in terms of your career, how much time did you spend at Miami? Was all your career there, or did you end up going somewhere else?
No, I spent my first 6-7 years in Miami, and then I was very, very lucky. I was assigned to our consulate in Milan, Italy. I think for many of my years of toiling in South Florida and carrying the water, and they rewarded me by a tour in Milan, Italy. So that was I spent a couple of years in Dallas, Texas.
Let's talk about Italy for a sec. Oh, that had to be tough duty. So what kind of stuff were you doing in Milan besides having cappuccinos, you know, and sitting outside and having a good Pinot Grigio in the evening?
No, you're absolutely right. And it's interesting because I went from doing a fair amount of, you know, like undercover work in between things, running my own cases with my partners, very hands-on. And Milan, to be honest, was like 100%, 98% just liaison. You were just connecting dots. What we ended up doing there is really, Colombia was still a big deal, and there were a lot of Colombian traffickers coming into Europe at the time. So we did a lot of liaison between the Italian cops and DEA in Colombia. So that's really how we made our presence.
One thing about Italy, there are so many law enforcement organizations. I remember we actually, at one year at the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the Carabinieri.
Carabinieri
in their fancy uniform showed up with their Lamborghini. Nice.
Aren't they cool? Yeah.
Showed up with their Lamborghini Diablo.
Here's
what I figured out. This is what they told me. I don't know how true it is. You tell me. They go, look, in Italy, in Italia, if we get there first, we run the show. So that's one of the reasons why I had the Diablos. They wanted to be the first ones there. But you had competing organizations in Italy, didn't you?
There were three main groups: the Carabinieri, La Guardia di Finanza, which is like an IRS and customs on steroids, and then there was the police, just la polizia, and they would. And then there was customs and other crews. But yeah, those three people played pretty hard against each other.
Did you go visit the Vatican?
I did not per se visit. I had actually been to the Vatican once before, which was a big time. I enjoyed that. I went to the Vatican with a friend of mine that was a priest actually here from Florida, from Florida. But no, I didn't go that time to the Vatican itself. I was in Rome a lot, but not to the Vatican. I mean, I'm sure I went to St. Peter's in the Basilica outside in the courtyard, but not like inside the museum. They have a very, very incredible museum there.
So was that a 3-year tour for you?
I was there 4 years, and then went to Giddy Up Dallas.
Giddy Up Dallas? Mm-hmm. What'd you do down in Dallas?
I was a group supervisor. That's the first time I get promoted, and I spend two years there. And I end up coming back to Miami again as a supervisor for about 3 or 4. And then I make my way, like we all do, here to headquarters, where I get to meet Mr. Murphy for the second time. You know, he's got a little bit less hair, a little bit more gray, and now he's the legendary Pablo Escobar hunter. You know,
he's famous in my own mind.
Oh man, Steve, I've got a lot of drinks paid for me by dropping your name. When I would tell people, this,
go for it, brother.
No, it's true. When Narcos was like happening, I would tell people, I know Chris Feistel and Steve Murphy. Ah, bullshit. Ah, that's not true. And then I'd show them photos. They go, wow. Here. I'll that's on me. I'll take that. That vodka tonic's on me. I was showing the pictures. Yeah, yeah, both of them.
I was telling Murph, my son was working out in Hayward, California. He works for Castle Security, and he was coming back. And they had, that was the conference you're at, Steve. You spoke out at RSA Security for, I think it was Force Point.
Yeah.
Flying back, and he's sitting next to this guy, and this guy's got a signed copy of Manhunters. And he's going on and on about Murphy. I got to meet these guys. It was really cool. And my son looks at him and says, yeah, my dad does a podcast with him. He just kind of like drops it in there.
Yeah.
If he'd looked in the book, he'd have seen one of our business cards for Game of Crimes.
Yeah.
But Alex and I were ASACs, Assistant Special Agents, in charge together in Special Operations Division.
You got the Derek Maltz treatment too.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, let
me say, and nobody can stand up to Derek like Alex here. I'm telling you.
You know how Derek is.
He talks you down. Alex can talk Derek down. It was hilarious. We had some of the best meetings.
Derek is so passionate. Yeah. You know, he'd sit at the guard booth out there. Remember when people were leaving?
Oh, we got that story. And he would pay Murph.
He would.
Murph was the snitch. He would pay, people would pay Murph to let them know. And actually it was Paul Crane. Paul had Murph, they paid Murph to let him know when Derek was out there at the guard booth waiting for people to leave early.
And then he'd stop you and says, where are you going? And people be like, excuse me, you're the sack. Why are you in that guard booth? You know, because I'm trying to keep people working late. Yeah. You know?
It's hard to in the right place. He put the video camera for the guard booth in my office. Paul Crane and Jamie Hunt come to me one day and they're like, listen, Murph, a phone call. Here's $3. Just a phone call. That's all we're asking
for. For $3. What self-respecting snitch does it for $3?
Oh, man.
We had some good times.
Yeah. But look, man, you know, I met guys like Steve and listen, and I didn't mention, because I'm talking to you, Morgan, is one of my best sort of like memories. I don't remember a lot of details about some of the cases and stuff. I don't, but I remember the people, man, in this job around the world. And even in the United States, you meet cops that I was always just so damn impressed, you know, just smart guys that, you know, I don't know if the public is understand. They keep people alive, not even realizing that they do, how they'll diffuse things. You know, we're in this environment, you know, where there's a lot of different views, shall we say, on police and policing. And can we improve in some areas? Probably, but or absolutely. But man, my favorite thing was just meeting a lot of the people that I met and thinking back. And I still keep in contact with some of these guys.
Wait a minute. You stay in contact with him?
No, not with per se, but a lot of other cops I have. Oh, yeah.
Hey, what did you do? Oh, send him a pipe and tobacco for Christmas?
No, get it a pipe? No.
Try this pipe instead, Captain.
Well, if you use mine,
that's a good one. I like that.
Leave remarks.
Yeah. What's that, Steve?
I said, if you use mining cable and you wrap it in like duct tape or electrical tape, it won't leave any marks.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
See, thanks for the pro tip there, Murph, on restraint. So how did you end up your career at DEA?
Pretty much here in headquarters. And then I led a very fruitful about 10, 11 years as a contractor. You know, as you know, a lot of us, you retire and your security clearance is still good. And, you know, the government, went through, especially during the famous, the GWAT, the Global War on Terror, there was a big brain drain, you know, and they just really couldn't probably afford to let people go. And there was these contracts, you know, that Steve was on one, that was very serious work and so forth. And again, great experience.
You did some stuff with Afghanistan.
Yeah. I was an executive mentor toward the general who ran the intelligence directorate, and very interesting guy. He was, I think he probably was a former Mujahideen himself, and I think he probably killed a Russian or two in his day. He never wanted to talk about it much, but I always made sure I was in good graces with him. You know, very damn quiet right. guy. Yeah. But it's funny. Go ahead.
When you were in Kabul, so was that a one-year contract?
Those contracts basically would go like a year at a time. And then, they generally would get renewed. As long as the contract, the company still had the money.
Where did you sleep at over there?
We ended up staying in a contractor compound just outside the airport. I never slept really comfortably. I never felt the security. You look at those guard posts and, you just say, hey, you know, here by the grace of God, go I and us. So,
did they keep you up
in the DEA compound?
Yeah, no, we didn't live in the DEA compound. Yeah. We were armed, in the contracts that I was on. The first one I was not, but on the other one I was, you know, and look, man, I still got the photos. It is a little unsettling that you'll go to one of these, entry points and there's still a pink mist on the wall, you know?
Attacks too. They had some of the Afghan soldiers who would turn. They killed that one U.S. general. They killed some other folks. You know,
there were several instances of it, of fratricide, no doubt. Very sad, very sad. So yeah, I never rested. If you were like a guy that enjoyed being there or that were fully relaxed, there were always a few hammerheads getting drunk and all that. And believe me, I'm no stranger to a vodka tonic, but. I kept my wits about me. You know what they'd say about people there when you went as a contractor? You would become one of three things: a hunk, a drunk, or a chunk. You know, and what they would say, you would become a hunk because, like, I was working out twice a day because there's nothing really else to do. Or you would become a chunk because I saw some guys, all they do is just eat all day. They sit in their cubicle there in their little hole in the wall watching porn or something and just eating, you know, and hunk, a chunk, or a drunk, you know. And and some people sadly did. I met a few that they would just get drunk. I'm thinking, dude, if we need to like mobilize and get your shit together here, you're I'm gonna probably throw you out first, let you become fodder.
Hey, interesting question. The time, you know, Joe Piersante.
Yes.
I don't know exactly when you were there, but did his incident overlap where he got shot? Was that when you were in Afghanistan?
It might have been. Yeah. What year was that exactly? Again, I hate to say that happened to him.
I'm looking now. Remember.
Yeah, Steve's pulling that up. We're trying to figure out when that was. But as he does that, it's kind of, you're right. We call them the Beltway Bandits around here. The old joke we used to have is they'd have generals retire from the Pentagon or these other places and admirals. And on a Friday and Monday morning, they'd be working somewhere else. But they're always late on their first day of work because they're waiting for their driver to show up. And it's like, man, you're in the private sector. There is no driver.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because, the Italians were a little bit, they did it right. Like if you were an Italian cop or any of these guys, and if you were even like an ASAC, Steve, they had drivers, you know, and they didn't believe that we were who we were and that we would just drive ourselves around, you know. You know, I'll leave you with this one saying that I've quoted it many times. One of my Italian counterparts early on, I said to him, listen, these kind of defendants that you're getting here a lot, are they likely to cooperate? How is it? Is it easy? Are they rough, tough guys? He goes, and I'll say it in Italian, and then I'll tell you what he goes. Bisogna metterle uno schiaffo per farlo parlare, poi 10 schiaffi per farle stare zitto. And basically he says, are you kidding? You need to slap him once to get him to start talking, and then you got to slap him 10 times to get him to shut up. You know. And he would say, and I remember just falling out of my chair laughing, the belly aching, the way this Italian guy said it. So since he goes, you slap them once to get them to talk, and then 10 times to get them to shut up. Schiaffo. Oh, man. No, cops, that's what I'm telling you. When I finish this thing I do in my life, it's all these guys like you that I've met. man, that have made this worthwhile. My family and all that is great, and I'm blessed. But I tell you, having met the people that I've met is what made this whole thing worthwhile.
Well, I'm sure you've read Dave Gaddis's book.
Yes, yes.
We had Dave on. He talked about you, and I was just looking here in the back of the book, and the very first footnote says Alex Dominguez wrote a book about some of his DEA stories. Did you write a book?
I wrote more of, I call it more of like a collection of short stories of things. Yeah, I got about eight.
Is it published?
No, it's not published. I could, but I haven't. I give it to friends and family and whatnot.
So that's the chapter two that you sent me about Miami Vice.
That was one. Yeah, that was one. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I talk about a few different things.
So I found the date real quick for Joe Pierisanti. It was October 30th, 31, 2011.
Yes, I was there.
Oh, wow. Mm.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah.
October. Yeah. You know what? Because earlier in that year, I'd gone over to Afghanistan for a couple of weeks on a TDY.
Really?
Yeah. And I was going to mention the, I don't know if you ever ate at the DEA compound, but they had a retired Army cook there that was just an unbelievable cook.
Yeah, no, the food was good at the DEA compound. It was
fantastic.
And Camp, I forget the name now, Camp.
It's Camp Get the Hell Out of There as Quick as You Can.
That's about right.
Let's bring this to a close by asking, what are you doing now? I mean, you did that contracting stuff. Are you just enjoying life now? Are you retired? Are you still doing the Beltway Bandit or doing some contracting stuff? What are you doing?
What I do now is interestingly enough, I help Dave Gaddis out once in a while. He's got his consulting firm that he still does some work. My last real sort of official full-time thing ended right about kind of like halfway through the pandemic. I was actually working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, assigned at SOD, being their rep. They didn't have enough folks yet, so I did that. But no, I don't like to say I'm fully retired because my wife doesn't want me to, but I'm getting close, man. I need to get a fishing rod. I need to improve my golf game. Do you play golf, guys?
I was going to say, I played one time. I scored higher than everybody else. They told me I lost. That's bullshit. But that's true. That's actually a true story.
Yeah. Well, but if you don't golf, at least hope you fish.
Yeah. Well, I hit the WNOD trail on my bike a lot. I'll go out towards Percival, up to Lubbockville and stuff, hit the winery or a brewery. So I'm not above that. Yeah.
There you go.
One thing Alex is not telling you, didn't you experiment with another? I know you did because we were at McManaman's house and we talked about this.
Yep.
He experimented with another career. You got to tell us about.
Yeah.
Porn star? Was it after watching all the porn?
Not that one yet. But I decided I wanted to try to do stand up comedy more than anything as a challenge, and let me tell you, we've done a lot of scary things, and you have no idea to go out there on a stage. And there's, sometimes it's only 40, 50 people. It ain't like there's 100, 92,000, but still 50, 60, 100 people. And if you don't say something funny and it's dead silence, man, I've seen it happen a couple of times or the pushed laugh. So I did it. And I found it harder than it is. You know what the secret sauce is, believe it or not, for that stuff, guys, is even the pros, the famous ones, they write. Like every no day. Tomorrow.
Yeah.
They write. All that stuff you see on those Netflix hours-long specials, that's not riffing. They write pieces of it, and they write it again, and they practice, and they go out, and they do their own little stand-up open mic stuff.
Where they test it out. Yeah.
And by the way, if you are a hardcore comedian, the pros, you can only do about one a year. That's how hard it is. So these guys are incredible. So I could do basically 5, 6, 7 minutes, but I wrote my material. It's funny. A lot of these guys, you write it. Like when I said it, it was funny. But one of the things I make some jokes about being a Hispanic, and I say I am married to a Hispanic woman. She is very hot, muy caliente. In fact, muy caliente. In fact, my wife treats me just like a stripper. How you ask? Because just like a stripper, I have spent considerable sums of money on both, knowing in advance that neither will be having sex with me. now you just write that, and how you deliver it and how you package it before or after. See, so if you at least laugh with just, you know, so you do that again and again. And if it sounds a little funny, you try. But it's hard, bro. It's hard.
It's time. I'll tell you, we heard Jerry, when I was a company called Cisco, you know, they actually brought Jerry Seinfeld in. And I watched a couple of his interviews and they were saying, what's some of his tricks? It's what he did. He writes every day, jokes every day. I mean, to your point, it's not like, yeah, he's doing something every single day, you know, to work on the craft. I look at guys like Dave Chappelle with his Netflix stuff. I know he got into a lot of controversy, but him, Ricky Gervais, folks like that, they are masters at delivering and bringing you, taking you all around and then bringing it back home, you know, at the very end. It's like, it's like a collection of jokes, but these jokes are stories. Some of them kind of serious, but they all make a point. And then at the end of the day, at the end of the special or the end of that their show, they bring it together with that final story that just makes everything make sense. I mean, so it's really an art.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, Alex is one of the, especially when we were at SOD together, he's one of the funnest people I've ever talked to. That's why I thought you were just going to be a huge success.
No, I did that more for fun, you know. And my last one, kind of when I was doing that whole thing, and it took me, believe it or not, weeks to kind of finish it. And I'm talking about, you know, having been an immigrant with my parents, and I say to the people that my mother, when she comes to the United States, gets afflicted with this very common medical condition that afflicts a lot of American women. She develops an iron deficiency. And she just basically woke up one day and told my father, oye, cabrón, I'm not going to iron your shirts anymore. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. Yeah. And so my dad said,
cabrón, no más, no more.
So my dad said, my goddamn, my wife developed an iron deficiency. Yeah. You know,
so it sounds like that joke.
Oh yeah. My wife had to hear that joke when she's sitting there in front of a bunch of people. People are like, who's the stripper lady that doesn't have sex with them?
I see a follow up episode in our future, the Alex Mingus Comedy Hour.
No. You guys are too kind.
Good stuff.
Well, man. Well, first of all, this is me saluting you. First of all, great backstory. The way you overcame a lot of stuff. It was not easy. You know, coming out of Cuba during that time, doing what you did. You went to the University of Miami. That I'm going to just give you a mulligan on. I'll give you a pass on. But okay. No, but hey, but you know, here's a kid, just put it in perspective, quits a $38,000 a year job to go take a $17,000 a year job to serve our great country. So this is me saluting you, pal.
Thank you. Thank you, brothers. Same to you. Back to you.
I knew this was going to be a good interview. I knew it was going to be funny. I've learned things about you, Alex, that I didn't know. We've been friends a long time. We'll be friends.
Well, thank you for having me, and God bless you guys, man. God bless you and your families.
All right.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you. Don't go anywhere. You hold on for just a second. Everyone else, stay tuned for the debrief. You know, he should have just gone into stand-up comedy while he was at DEA and kind of been like Todd McComas and just, hey, take my wife, please.
Oh, I'll tell you what. And you know what he did? Well, you heard him talk about it. He tried the stand-up comedy, and he was a natural. But then he realized how much work it was. And I didn't know it was that much work for comedians. Maybe we should have introduced you to Todd McComas, who is a stand-up comedian now after being a police officer. But Alex just has...
He was a trooper, Murph. He was a trooper.
I know, and he finally got out of it and got a real job. So good job, Todd. Hey, all my trooper buddies, you know, if you want to write my wife a ticket, okay, but please be nice to me. I'll change your tires for you. How about that? But when you bring on an old friend here like Alex, it's like old home week, and can't say thank you enough, Alex, for taking the time to give us an interview, put up with our junk here, wish you all the best in retirement, brother. I know you got a lot going on in your life.
Well, and he's still got the jokes too. And wait, if you heard the last part of it, you'll heard him try out some of his material. Like I said, he should have just done it. He just should have gone up and been himself. But you know what, Murph, though? That's what this is about. You got to, if you can get out of this job and this kind of career with your sense of humor intact, that's a win.
Exactly. And you want somebody like that. That's what helps you get through these type of jobs.
Yes, it does. Well, guys, we hope you enjoyed that episode. That is episode 99. What are we going to do for episode 100? Even we don't know yet, but we're going to find out. So, hey, go over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars. It's magic. We don't know how it works. It's David Copperfield, David Blaine, all of that good stuff. We know it just works. Also, head on over to GameOfCrimesPodcast.com. for more info about the show and our book list. That's one of our popular features. We list all of the books that our guests have written. Also, follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. You can also go to Game of Crimes Fans, search for that. Sandy Salvato, our mafia queen, runs that with a velvet fist. Just answer a couple questions, get admittance into the inner sanctum, and hilarity will ensue. But where you got to be, where you also got to be, is Patreon. Patreon.com, right, Murph, / Game of Crimes. Now, don't put Patreon.com, right, Murph, / Game of Crimes. It's Patreon.com, / Game of Crimes.
Damn, I was right, writing Murph? That down, too. I was writing that down. I thought I had it wrong.
Hey, I had to write 911 and stick it up, put a sticky note on your desk when I was down there visiting you. But that's where you got to be, guys. We got some episodes. We got some good stuff coming out. Again, we do 911, what's your emergency? You can't make this shit up. We do the narcometer. We do Q&A, one of our favorite things. We do for our Warden of the Throne. We have an exclusive video just for them. So we've got lots of good stuff for you folks. But we want to thank you guys. And we'll see. We're going to try and do something special for episode 100. But we're only at 100 because of you. And we want to sincerely thank all of you for your support, for helping us out, and for helping us once again playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous, and stand-up friendly game of all, the Funny Game of Crimes.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.